we're back.
Doug Sinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. California Dreamin', covered by the Beach Boys in 1985. I think they sing it better than the Mamas and Papas, personally. But that's a matter of debate. And do you think the Saints are California Dreamin' right now? They're in Los Angeles, and we'll see. They're getting healthy, or they'll have Taysom back. They'll have Olave back. Is Caesar back? Caesar Ruiz back, or is he still? So that's
Caesar Ruiz is back.
So we got a little, you know, sort of mixed emotions. No matter who's the coach, if you don't have the horses, you're not going to win. And they haven't had players, so we'll see. We'll see if he can coach them up and take care of the Chargers. All right, let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Steve in Baton Rouge, a town in mourning, Baton Rouge this morning. He's got a question regarding an appeal. Hey, Steve, you're on All Things Legal. What you got for us, brother?
Thank you. I am a plaintiff in a restraining order with four other individuals against a neighbor, and they are appealing. The defendant is appealing the restraining order, and it's going to the Fifth Circuit Appeals Court.
Yes.
And we no longer have the attorney who represented us in the original court battle with the restraining order, which we were successful. And they are appealing it based on a few administrative things that the judge did that they claim was in error. Now, we are no longer represented. How does the appellate process work, and should we be represented in this process?
No, absolutely. First of all, you have the opportunity to file a response brief to the brief that is filed by, in this case, the defendants, who would be the appellants. You would be the appellee, the person opposing the appeal. You'd have the opportunity to file a brief. The other issue would be is whether the appellants or defendants, in this case, requested oral argument. The oral argument will occur 2 or 3 months after the briefs are submitted. So you're going to need an attorney to do two things. One is to submit an appellee brief or a response brief to their brief. And you could put in all the, you know, contest all the arguments and procedural objections they may have in this appellee brief. Then you would have oral argument. Now, typically in an appeal to Louisiana Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals or any circuit court of appeals, you will have three judges who normally preside over the case. And the three judges will ultimately issue a judgment. You could have a situation where they all three agree. You have a situation where two agree and one doesn't. You could have a situation where if it's a matter of law, they could decide to, possibly all deal with them, or have a full panel, which is very rare. But for the most part, you're going to need an attorney to file that appellant brief to respond to the brief that is filed by the appellee brief to respond to the appellant. And you also, too, you can make whatever objections, make sure they filed it on time, make sure they filed the proper procedures to an appeal, make sure these issues are appealable. There's a lot of procedural and substantive issues you can address, and then you will also need them for oral argument if it has been properly requested.
What if I am one of four. And nobody wants to move further. They even the attorney said it would probably be a waste of money to submit a brief. Can one of us be in court and object verbally during the process?
No, I don't think you would be able to. I can't say that with certainty. But if you don't file a brief, you may waive your opportunity to object because you haven't provided to the court, you know, what your position is, you know, in writing. The appellate court's not the people's court. You know, you can't go in there and sort of start talking with Judge Judy. I mean, this is a lot more formality to it, a lot more rules. There's certain rules on as far as what you can argue. Basically, your argument has to be based on the record and not a lot outside of it. So if they did let you speak, they would be highly irritated and rolling their eyes because they would probably not take kindly to it. I think that would be up to the judges previously whether they would let y'all argue or not. There's time periods that are involved. There's protocols that are involved. I don't know that they would let you argue in absence of submitting a brief because the court, you know, these appellate judges want to see what your argument is. And what they do is when they read the briefs, they'll give you 15 minutes. Now, you can break it up if you're the appellant, that you can break it up for some for rebuttal. But basically, they read the briefs and start asking questions based on issues that are raised in the brief. So if you don't file a brief, they may not allow you to argue because you haven't put anything before the court. So, you know, if you wanted to, I would call the clerk of these judges and ask them. I'd call the first Fifth Circuit Court. I forgot her name. She's very, very good. You could ask her, saying, "Hey, we're not planning on filing a brief. Do you think the judges will let us argue?" And she'll talk to them, and they may say yes. They may say no. You may want to check to make sure that oral argument.
I would think probably not. If you're not going to file a brief, then they're not going to sit there and let you go argue something that you did not file. So, look, it depends. It depends on how vehemently you want to oppose this or support this restraining order. If this is something you really want to do and, you know, have it effective, then hire an attorney, get them to review all the documentation, or at least to review the defendant's brief and file the appeal on your behalf. If you want to just let it go by the wayside, you know, sometimes it's a financial decision when it comes to these types of decisions with restraining orders and just various, you know, various other types of litigation where it's, look, it's not worth the money anymore. Whatever happens, happens. And if you don't care, then, you know, don't get a lawyer and don't fight it. But if it's something you're still interested in, and look, you may still win. The court may just look at it and say, no, there's no real right here, but I think they're going to find it curious that you had an attorney and now all of a sudden nobody's responding to this brief. So it's a decision you guys have to make. But if you decide to move forward, absolutely yes, get an attorney.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Kevin from Metairie, home of the West Esplanade Canal. Metairie, what do you have for us, Kevin?
Hi, my parents passed and they bought a house in the 60s for like $40,000. Now it's worth about $1 million. And I'm trying to see what we possibly could do with capital gains tax. I have a brother and sister, so it's going to be a three-way division. But
have you been placed in possession yet?
No, right now it's a... Yeah, right now they're doing with the will and all.
Oh, yeah. Your parents are still living?
No, they passed.
Okay, they passed. So they're passed. Probating the will. Right. All right, right. Capital gains, how long ago did they pass?
The last one, about 2 months ago.
Okay, well, I don't think capital gains will be less of an issue because you get what is called a stepped-up basis, meaning that the basis for your capital gains tax will be based on the date of death of the parents and not based on the purchase price back in the 1960s.
So
what you want to do is evaluate the property. You know, there's a gray area, right? So if you evaluate it kind of to the higher end of the gray area, if you guys choose to sell it, you'll be placed in possession, and let's say it's worth $1 million, you'll be placed in possession at $1 million, and if you sell it for $1,050,000, you're only paying capital gains on $50,000. But if you sell it for $1 million, you pay no capital gains. So, because your basis becomes value at the time of death.
And
so that's what you base your capital gains on.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Okay. Colin, you want to go to a break or you want to go through some text?
Let's go through a text real quick. Okay. We had someone text in and said, when I do power of attorney for clients with multiple agents, I include language that specifies that both agents acting in their individual capacities shall be recognized as my true and lawful agent. Identifying agents as primary and secondary is what causes the problem. I think this is referring to the earlier text we had about the two children power of attorney.
Yeah. Well, what they're saying is if you have co-agents, you could put language in there that each could act independently of the other. Okay, so you could theoretically say that I have two co-agents, I only need one to make a decision. But again, the problem is if they disagree, then you got a problem. Because if they're acting independently of each other and they want to do something that is opposite of each other, then you're back at an impasse. But theoretically, in a power of attorney, if you want two agents, you can put language in there saying that they could act independently of each other, but it doesn't necessarily solve your problem as having two co-agents who may have two different ideas as to course of action, which are mutually exclusive and opposite. But that's a good text. Good text. Got another one?
Yeah, actually, this one's pretty simple, but it could be a doozy. Again, you guys are the lawyers, not me. Someone said, how does one set up an estate account? Just go to the bank, and do I do this before I die or after someone else dies? Like, how does that work?
So your executor, executrix, or anyone applying for the administrative position, if there's no will, will open up the succession, be appointed, and once they are appointed, then it's a very simple process. You get on the IRS's website, and there's a tab for it's very efficient. It's one of the things that is extremely efficient for the federal government. They want to give you a tax ID number so you can go ahead and open an account and start paying taxes, right? So what you do is you get an EIN number or a tax ID number, and you will be there's a specific box to check for executors of estates, and so or succession representatives, and you check it. You give them your social. You give them the deceased's social, and all, you know. And it's a very simple form, and usually within 24 hours they will send you a sheet with your name as you know in your position as the administrator, and a new tax ID number. You bring that to the bank and say, look, I want to transfer this money into that account. And, you know, it's a very simple process. We typically do that for our administrators, executives that come into the office and you know, open a succession. It's a simple process.
All right.